of hard drives and a multi-channel audio console that appeared to have its own filtered power supply. Why in the world would anyone work all the way up here? Kalle moved toward the gear. Have you examined the system? It's a listening post. Kalle spun. Surveillance? The agent nodded. Very advanced surveillance. He motioned to a long project table strewn with electronic parts, manuals, tools, wires, soldering irons, and other electronic components. Someone clearly knows what he's doing. A lot of this gear is as sophisticated as our own equipment. Miniature microphones, photoelectric recharging cells, high-capacity RAM chips. He's even got some of those new nano hard drives. Kalle was impressed. Here's a complete system, the agent said, handing Kalle an assembly not much larger than a pocket calculator. Dangling off the contraption was a foot-long wire with a stamp-sized piece of wafer-thin foil stuck on the end. The base is a high-capacity hard-disk audio recording system with rechargeable battery. That strip of foil at the end of the wire is a combination microphone and photoelectric recharging cell. Kalle knew them well. These foil-like photocell mics had been an enormous breakthrough a few years back. Now, a hard-disk recorder could be affixed behind a lamp, for example, with its foil microphone molded into the contour of the base and dyed to match. As long as the microphone was positioned such that it received a few hours of sunlight per day, the photocells would keep recharging the system. Bugs like this one could listen indefinitely. "Reception method?" Kalle asked. The agent signaled to an insulated wire that ran out of the back of the computer up the wall through a hole in the barn roof. "Simple radio wave. Small antenna on the roof." Kalle knew these recording systems were generally placed in offices, were voice-activated to save hard disk space, and recorded snippets of conversation during the day, transmitting compressed audio files at night to avoid detection. After transmitting, the hard drive erased itself and prepared to do it all over again the next day. "Any idea what target is being bugged?" "Well, Lieutenant," the agent said, walking to the computer monitor, "that's the incredible thing." Chapter 88. Langdon felt utterly spent as he and Sophie hurtled a turnstile at the embankment tube station and dashed deep into the bowels of the grimy labyrinth of tunnels and platforms. The guilt ripped through him. "I involved Lee, and now he's in enormous danger." Remy's involvement had been a shock, and yet it made obvious sense. Whoever was pursuing the Grail had recruited someone on the inside. They went to Teebings for the same reason I did. Throughout history, those who held knowledge of the Grail had always been magnets for thieves and scholars alike. The fact that Teebing had been a target all along should have made Langdon feel less guilty about involving him. It did not. "We need to find Lee and help him immediately." Langdon followed Sophie to the uptown platform, where she hurried to a payphone to call the police, despite Remy's warning to the contrary. Langdon sat on a grungy bench nearby, feeling remorseful.
"The best way to help Lee," Sophie reiterated as she dialed, "is to involve the London authorities immediately. Trust me."
Langdon had not initially agreed with this idea, but as they had hatched their plan, Sophie's logic began to make sense. Teebing was safe at the moment. Even if Remy and the others knew where the Knight's Tomb was located, they still might need Teebing's help deciphering the orb reference. What worried Langdon was what would happen after the Grail map had been found.
Lee will become a huge liability.
If Langdon were to have any chance of helping Lee, or of ever seeing the Keystone again, it was essential that he find the tomb first.
Unfortunately, Remy had a big head start.
Slowing Remy down had become Sophie's task. Finding the right tomb had become Langdon's. Sophie would make Remy and Silas fugitives of the London police, forcing them into hiding or, better yet, catching them. Langdon's plan was less certain: to take the tube to nearby King's College, which was renowned for its electronic theological database, the ultimate research tool, Langdon had heard, instant answers to any religious historical question. He wondered what the database would have to say about a knight a pope interred. He stood up and paced, wishing the train would hurry. At the payphone, Sophie's call finally connected to the London police.
Snow Hill Division, the dispatcher said. How may I direct your call?
I'm reporting a kidnapping.
Sophie knew to be concise.
Name, please?
Sophie paused.
Agent Sophie Neveu, with the French Judicial Police.
The title had the desired effect.
Right away, ma'am. Let me get a detective on the line for you.
As the call went through, Sophie began wondering if the police would even believe her description of Teabing's captors.
A man in a tuxedo?
How much easier to identify could a suspect be? Even if Remy changed clothes, he was partnered with an albino monk.
Impossible to miss.
Moreover, they had a hostage and could not take public transportation. She wondered how many Jaguar-stretched limos there could be in London. Sophie's connection to the detective seemed to be taking forever.
Come on!
She could hear the line clicking and buzzing, as if she was being transferred. 15 seconds passed. Finally, a man came on the line.
Agent Neveu?
Stunned, Sophie registered the gruff tone immediately.
Agent Neveu, Bezu Fash demanded. Where the hell are you?
Sophie was speechless. Captain Fash had apparently requested the London police dispatcher to alert him if Sophie called in.
Listen,
Fash said, speaking to her in terse French.
I made a terrible mistake tonight. Robert Langdon is innocent. All charges against him have been dropped. Even so, both of you are in danger. You need to come in.
Sophie's jaw fell slack. She had no idea how to respond. Fash was not a man who apologized for anything.
You did not tell me, Fash continued, that Jacques Saunière was your grandfather. I fully intend to overlook your insubordination tonight on account of the emotional stress you must be under. At the moment, however, you and Langdon need to go into the nearest London police headquarters for refuge.
He knows I'm in London. What else does Fash know?
Sophie heard what sounded like drilling or machinery in the background. She also heard an odd clicking on the line.
Are you tracing this call, Captain?
Fash's voice was firm now.
You and I need to cooperate, Agent Neveu. We both have a lot to lose here. This is damage control. I made errors in judgment last night, and if those errors result in the deaths of an American professor and a DCPJ cryptologist, my career will be over. I've been trying to pull you back into safety for the last several hours.
A warm wind was now pushing through the station as a train approached with a low rumble. Sophie had every intention of being on it. Langdon apparently had the same idea. He was gathering himself together and moving toward her now.
The man you want is Remy Legaludec, Sophie said. He is Teabing's servant. He just kidnapped Sir Teabing inside the Temple Church and—
Agent Neveu!
Fash bellowed as the train thundered into the station.
This is not something to discuss on an open line. You and Langdon will come in now, for your own well-being. That is a direct order.
Sophie hung up and dashed with Langdon onto the train. Chapter 89. The immaculate cabin of Teabing's hawker was now covered with steel shavings and smelled of compressed air and propane. Bezu Fash had sent everyone away and now sat alone with his drink and the heavy wooden box found in Teabing's safe. Running his finger across the inlaid rows, he lifted the ornate lid. Inside he found a stone cylinder with lettered dials. The five dials were arranged to spell Sophia. Fash stared at the word a long moment, and then lifted the cylinder from its padded resting place and examined every inch. Then, pulling slowly on the ends, Fash slid off one of the end caps. The cylinder was empty. Fash set it back in the box and gazed absently out the jet's window at the hangar, pondering his brief conversation with Sophie, as well as the information he'd received from PTS in Chateau Villette. His phone shook him from his daydream. It was the DCPJ switchboard. The dispatcher was apologetic. The president of the Depository Bank of Zurich had been calling repeatedly, and although he had been told several times that the captain was in London on business, he just kept calling. Begrudgingly, Fash told the operator to forward the call.
Monsieur Vernet?
Fache said, before the man could even speak.
I am sorry I did not call you earlier. I have been busy. As promised, the name of your bank has not appeared in the media. So what precisely is your concern?
Vernet's voice was anxious, as he told Fache how Langdon and Sophie had extracted a small wooden box from the bank, and then persuaded Vernet to help them escape.
Then, when I heard on the radio that they were criminals, Vernet said, I pulled over and demanded the box back, but they attacked me and stole the truck. You are concerned for a wooden box?
Fache said, eyeing the rose inlay on the cover and again gently opening the lid to reveal the white cylinder.
Can you tell me what was in the box? The contents are immaterial, Vernet fired back. I am concerned with the reputation of my bank. We have never had a robbery, ever. It will ruin us if I cannot recover this property on behalf of my client. You said Agent Nevers and Robert Langdon had a password and a key. What makes you say they stole the box? They murdered people tonight, including Sophie Nevers' grandfather. The key and password were obviously ill-gotten. Mr. Vernet, my men have done some checking into your background and your interests. You are obviously a man of great culture and refinement. I would imagine a man of honor as well, as am I. That said, I give you my word as commanding officer of the police judiciaire that your box, along with your bank's reputation, are in the safest of hands.
Chapter 90. High in the hayloft at Chateau Villette, Collet stared at the computer monitor in amazement.
This system is eavesdropping on all these locations?
Yes, the agent said. It looks like data had been collected for over a year now.
Collet read the list again, speechless.
Colbert Sostac, chairman of the Conseil Constitutionnel. Jean Chaffet, curator Musée Jeu de Paume. Édouard Desrochers, senior archivist, Mitterrand Library. Jacques Saunière, curator, Musée du Louvre. Michel Breton, head of DAS, France Intelligence.
The agent pointed to the screen.
Number 4 is of obvious concern.
Collet nodded blankly. He had noticed it immediately. Jacques Saunière was being bugged. He looked at the rest of the list again.
How could anyone possibly manage to bug these prominent people?
Have you heard any of the audio files? A few. Here's one of the most recent.
The agent clicked a few computer keys. The speakers crackled to life.
Capitaine, un agent du département de cryptographie est arrivé.
Collet could not believe his ears.
That's me. That's my voice.
He recalled sitting at Sonnier's desk and radioing Fache in the Grand Gallery to alert him of Sophie Nevers' arrival. The agent nodded.
A lot of our Louvre investigation tonight would have been audible if someone had interest.
Have you sent anyone to sweep for the bug?
No need. I know exactly where it is.
The agent went to a pile of old notes and blueprints on the work table. He selected a page and handed it to Collet.
Look familiar?
Collet was amazed. He was holding a photocopy of an ancient schematic diagram, which depicted a rudimentary machine. He was unable to read the handwritten Italian labels, and yet he knew what he was looking at. A model for a fully articulated medieval French knight.
The knight sitting on Sonnier's desk.
Collet's eyes moved to the margins, where someone had scribbled notes on the photocopy in red felt-tipped marker. The notes were in French, and appeared to be ideas outlining how best to insert a listening device into the night. Chapter 91. Silas sat in the passenger seat of the parked Jaguar limousine near Temple Church. His hands felt damp on the keystone as he waited for Remy to finish tying and gagging Teabing in the back with the rope they had found in the trunk. Finally, Remy climbed out of the rear of the limo, walked around, and slid into the driver's seat beside Silas.
Secure?
Silas asked. Remy chuckled, shaking off the rain and glancing over his shoulder through the open partition at the crumpled form of Lee Teabing, who was barely visible in the shadows in the rear. He is not going anywhere. Silas could hear Teabing's muffled cries and realized Remy had used some of the old duct tape to gag him.
Ferme ta gueule!
Remy shouted over his shoulder at Teabing. Reaching to a control panel on the elaborate dash, Remy pressed a button. An opaque partition raised behind them, sealing off the back. Teabing disappeared, and his voice was silenced. Remy glanced at Silas.
I've been listening to his miserable whimpering long enough.
Minutes later, as the Jaguar stretch limo powered through the streets, Silas's cell phone rang.
The teacher.
He answered excitedly.
Hello? Silas,
the teacher's familiar French accent said.
I am relieved to hear your voice. This means you are safe.
Silas was equally comforted to hear the teacher. It had been hours, and tonight's operation had veered wildly off course. Now at last it seemed to be back on track.
I have the keystone. This is superb news, the teacher told him. Is Remy with you?
Silas was surprised to hear the teacher use Remy's name.
Yes, Remy freed me, as I ordered him to do. I am only sorry you had to endure captivity for so long. Physical discomfort has no meaning. The important thing is that the keystone is ours. Yes, I need it delivered to me at once. Time is of the essence.
Silas was eager to meet the teacher face to face at last.
Yes, sir, I would be honored.
Silas, I would like Remy to bring it to me.
Remy?
Silas was crestfallen. After everything Silas had done for the teacher, he had believed he would be the one to hand over the prize.
The teacher favors Remy?
I sense your disappointment, the teacher said, which tells me you do not understand my meaning. He lowered his voice to a whisper.
You must believe that I would much prefer to receive the keystone from you, a man of God, rather than a criminal. But Remy must be dealt with. He disobeyed my orders and made a grave mistake that has put our entire mission at risk.
Silas felt a chill and glanced over at Remy. Kidnapping Sir Teabing had not been part of the plan, and deciding what to do with him posed a new problem.
You and I are men of God, the teacher whispered. We cannot be deterred from our goal.
There was an ominous pause on the line.
For this reason alone, I will ask Remy to bring me the keystone. Do you understand?
Silas sensed anger in the teacher's voice, and was surprised the man was not more understanding.
Showing his face was not to be avoided, Silas thought. Remy did what he had to do. He saved the keystone. I understand,
Silas managed.
Good. For your own safety, you need to get off the street immediately. The police will be looking for the limousine soon, and I do not want you caught. Does Opus Dei have a residence in London?
Of course.
And you are welcome there?
As a brother.
Then go there, and stay out of sight. I will call you the moment I am in possession of the keystone and have attended to my current problem.
You are in London?
Do as I say, and everything will be fine.
Yes, sir.
The teacher heaved a sigh, as if what he now had to do was profoundly regrettable.
It's time I speak to Remy.
Silas handed Remy the phone, sensing it might be the last call Remy Legoladec ever took. As Remy took the phone, he knew this poor, twisted monk had no idea what fate awaited him now that he had served his purpose.
The teacher used you, Silas, and your bishop is a pawn.
Remy still marveled at the teacher's powers of persuasion. Bishop Aringarosa had trusted everything. He had been blinded by his own desperation.
Aringarosa was far too eager to believe.
Although Remy did not particularly like the teacher, he felt pride at having gained the man's trust and helped him so substantially.
I have earned my payday.
Listen carefully, the teacher said. Take Silas to the Opus Dei residence hall and drop him off a few blocks away. Then drive to St. James Park. It is adjacent to Parliament and Big Ben. You can park the limousine on Horse Guards Way. We'll talk there.
With that, the connection went dead. Chapter 92 King's College, established by King George IV in 1829, was originally housed next to London's Somerset House on property granted by the Crown. Their Department of Religious Studies still resides on the college's original campus adjacent to Parliament. King's College Religion Department boasts not only 150 years' experience in teaching and research, but the 1982 establishment of the renowned Research Institute in Systematic Theology, which possesses one of the most complete and electronically advanced religious research libraries in the world. Langdon still felt shaky as he and Sophie came in from the rain and entered the library. The primary research room was as Teabing had described it, a dramatic octagonal chamber dominated by an enormous round table around which King Arthur and his knights might have been comfortable were it not for the presence of 12 flat-screen computer workstations. On the far side of the room, a reference librarian was just pouring a pot of tea and settling in for her day of work.
"Lovely morning," she said in a cheerful British accent, leaving the tea and walking over. "May I help you?"
"Thank you, yes," Langdon replied. "My name is..."
"Robert Langdon."
She gave a pleasant smile.
"I know who you are."
For an instant, he feared Fash had put him on English television as well, but the librarian's smile suggested otherwise. Langdon still had not gotten used to these moments of unexpected celebrity. Then again, if anyone on Earth were going to recognize his face, it would be a librarian in a religious reference facility.
"Pamela Gettam," the librarian said, offering her hand.
She had a genial, erudite face and a pleasingly fluid voice. The horn-rimmed glasses hanging around her neck were thick. "A pleasure," Langdon said. "This is my friend, Sophie Neveu." The two women greeted one another, and Gettam turned immediately back to Langdon.
"I didn't know you were coming."
"Neither did we. If it's not too much trouble, we could really use your help finding some information." Gettam shifted, looking uncertain.
"Normally our services are by petition and appointment only. Unless, of course, you're the guest of someone at the college."
Langdon shook his head. "I'm afraid we've come unannounced. A friend of mine speaks very highly of you. Sir Lee Teabing?" Langdon felt a pang of gloom as he said the name. "The British royal historian?" Gettam brightened now, laughing.
"Heavens, yes, what a character, fanatical. Every time he comes in, it's always the same search strings. Grail, grail, grail. I swear that man will die before he gives up on that quest."
She winked.
"Time and money afford one such lovely luxuries, wouldn't you say? A regular Don Quixote, that one."
"Is there any chance you can help us?" Sophie asked. "It's quite important."
Gettam glanced around the deserted library and then winked at them both.
"Well, I can't very well claim I'm too busy now, can I? As long as you sign in, I can't imagine anyone being too upset. What did you have in mind?"
"We're trying to find a tomb in London." Gettam looked dubious.
"We've got about 20,000 of them. Could you be a little more specific?"
"It's the tomb of a knight. We don't have a name."
"A knight? That tightens the net substantially. Much less common."
"We don't have much information about the knight we are looking for," Sophie said, "but this is what we know."
She produced a slip of paper on which she had written only the first two lines of the poem. Hesitant to show the entire poem to an outsider, Langdon and Sophie had decided to share just the first two lines, those that identified the knight.
"Compartmentalized cryptography," Sophie had called it.
When an intelligence agency intercepted a code containing sensitive data, cryptographers each worked on a discrete section of the code. This way, when they broke it, no single cryptographer possessed the entire deciphered message. In this case, the precaution was probably excessive. Even if this librarian saw the entire poem, identified the knight's tomb, and knew what orb was missing, the information was useless without the cryptex. Gettam sensed an urgency in the eyes of this famed American scholar, almost as if finding this tomb quickly were a matter of critical importance. The green-eyed woman accompanying him also seemed anxious. Puzzled, Gettam put on her glasses and examined the paper they had just handed her.
"In London lies a knight, a pope interred. His labor's fruit a holy wrath incurred."
She glanced at her guests.
"What is this? Some kind of Harvard scavenger hunt?"
Langdon's laugh sounded forced. "Yeah, something like that." Gettam paused, feeling she was not getting the whole story. Nonetheless, she felt intrigued and found herself pondering the verse carefully.
"According to this rhyme,
a knight did something that incurred displeasure with God, and yet a pope was kind enough to bury him in London.
Langdon nodded. Does it ring any bells?
Gedham moved toward one of the workstations. Not offhand, but let's see what we can pull up in the database.
Over the past 2 decades, King's College Research Institute in Systematic Theology had used OCR text recognition software in unison with linguistic translation devices to digitize and catalog an enormous collection of texts, encyclopedias of religion, religious biographies, sacred scriptures in dozens of languages, histories, Vatican letters, diaries of clerics, anything at all that qualified as writings on human spirituality. Because the massive collection was now in the form of bits and bytes rather than physical pages, the data was infinitely more accessible. Settling into one of the workstations, Gedham eyed the slip of paper and began typing.
To begin, we'll run a straight Boolean with a few obvious keywords and see what happens.
Thank you. Gedham typed in a few words. London, Knight, Pope. As she clicked the search button, she could feel the hum of the massive mainframe downstairs scanning data at a rate of 500 megabytes per second.
I'm asking the system to show us any documents whose complete text contains all three of these keywords. We'll get more hits than we want, but it's a good place to start.
The screen was already showing the first of the hits now. Painting the Pope, the collected portraits of Sir Joshua Reynolds, London University Press.
Gedham shook her head. Obviously not what you're looking for. She scrolled to the next hit.
The London Writings of Alexander Pope by G. Wilson Knight. Again, she shook her head. As the system churned on, the hits came up more quickly than usual. Dozens of texts appeared, many of them referencing the 18th-century British writer Alexander Pope, whose counter-religious mock-epic poetry apparently contained plenty of references to knights and London. Gedham shot a quick glance to the numeric field at the bottom of the screen. This computer, by calculating the current number of hits and multiplying by the percentage of the database left to search, provided a rough guess of how much information would be found. This particular search looked like it was going to return an obscenely large amount of data. Estimated number of total hits, 2,692.
We need to refine the parameters further, Gedham said, stopping the search. Is this all the information you have regarding the tomb? There's nothing else to go on.
Langdon glanced at Sophie Neveu, looking uncertain.
This is no scavenger hunt, Gedham sensed.
She had heard the whisperings of Robert Langdon's experience in Rome. This American had been granted access to the most secure library on Earth, the Vatican Secret Archives. She wondered what kinds of secrets Langdon might have learned inside, and if his current desperate hunt for a mysterious London tomb might relate to information he had gained within the Vatican. Gedham had been a religious librarian long enough to know the most common reason people came to London to look for knights. The Grail. Gedham smiled and adjusted her glasses.
You were friends with Lee Teabing. You're in England, and you're looking for a knight.
She folded her hands.
I can only assume you're on a Grail quest.
Langdon and Sophie exchanged startled looks. Gedham laughed.
My friends, this library is a base camp for Grail seekers, Lee Teabing among them. I wish I had a shilling for every time I'd run searches for the Rose, Mary Magdalene, Sangreal, Merovingian, Priory of Sion, etc., etc. Everyone loves a conspiracy.
She took off her glasses and eyed them.
I need more information.
In the silence, Gedham sensed her guest's desire for discretion quickly being outweighed by their eagerness for a fast result.
Here, Sophie Neveu blurted, this is everything we know.
Borrowing a pen from Langdon, she wrote 2 more lines on the slip of paper and handed it to Gedham. You seek the orb that ought be on his tomb. It speaks of rosy flesh and seeded womb. Gedham gave an inward smile.
The Grail, indeed, she thought, noting the references to the rose and her seeded womb. I can help you, she said, looking up from the slip of paper. Might I ask where this verse came from and why you were seeking an orb?
You might ask, Langdon said with a friendly smile. But it's a long story, and we have very little time.
Sounds like a polite way of saying mind your own business.
We would be forever in your debt, Pamela, Langdon said, if you could find out who this knight is and where he's buried.
Very well, Gedham said, typing again. I'll play along.
If this is a Grail-related issue, we should cross-reference against Grail keywords. I'll add a proximity parameter and remove the title weighting. That will limit our hits only to those instances of textual keywords that occur near a Grail-related word.
Search for Knight, London, Pope, Tomb within 100-word proximity of Grail, Rose, Sangreal, Chalice.
How long will this take? Sophie asked.
A few hundred terabytes with multiple cross-referencing fields?
Getham's eyes glimmered as she clicked the search key.
A mere 15 minutes.
Langdon and Sophie said nothing, but Getham sensed this sounded like an eternity to them.
Tea?
Getham asked, standing and walking toward the pot she had made earlier.
Lee always loves my tea.
Chapter 93 London's Opus Dei Center is a modest brick building at 5 Orme Court, overlooking the North Walk at Kensington Gardens. Silas had never been here, but he felt a rising sense of refuge and asylum as he approached the building on foot. Despite the rain, Remy had dropped him off a few blocks away in order to keep the limousine off the main streets. Silas didn't mind the walk. The rain was cleansing. At Remy's suggestion, Silas had wiped down his Glock and disposed of it through a sewer grate. He was glad to get rid of it. He felt lighter. His legs still ached from being bound all that time, but Silas had endured far greater pain. He wondered, though, about Sir Teabing, who Remy had left bound in the back of the limousine. The Briton certainly had to be feeling the pain by now.
"What will you do with him?"
Silas had asked Remy as they drove over here. Remy had shrugged.
"That is a decision for the teacher."
There was an odd finality in his tone. Now, as Silas approached the Opus Dei building, the rain began to fall harder, soaking his heavy robe, stinging the wounds of the day before. He was ready to leave behind the sins of the last 24 hours and purge his soul. His work was done. Moving across a small courtyard to the front door, Silas was not surprised to find the door unlocked. He opened it and stepped into the minimalist foyer. A muted electronic chime sounded upstairs as Silas stepped onto the carpet. The bell was a common feature in these halls where the residents spent most of the day in their rooms in prayer. Silas could hear movement above on the creaky wood floors. A man in a cloak came downstairs.
"May I help you?"
He had kind eyes that seemed not even to register Silas's startling physical appearance.
"You look cold. You are a brother, I see."
"My name is Silas," he said, nodding.
"American?"
"Yes, traveling. I'm in town only for the day. Might I rest here?"
"You need not even ask. There are 2 empty rooms on the 3rd floor. Shall I bring you some tea and bread?"
"Thank you." Silas was famished. Silas went upstairs to a modest room with a window, where he took off his wet robe and knelt down to pray in his undergarments. He heard his host come up and lay a tray outside his door. Silas finished his prayers, ate his food, and lay down to sleep. 3 stories below, a phone was ringing. The Opus Dei prelate who had served Silas tea answered the line.
"This is the London police," the caller said. "We are trying to find an albino monk. We've had a tip-off that he might be there. Have you seen him?"
The prelate was startled.
"Yes, he is here. Is something wrong?"
"He is there now?"
"Yes, upstairs praying. What's going on?"
"Leave him precisely where he is," the officer commanded. "Don't say a word to anyone. I'm sending officers over right away."
Chapter 94 St. James's Park is a vast expanse of rolling lawns whose sweeping boundaries are marked by 3 palaces, Westminster, Buckingham, and St. James's Palace. Once enclosed by King Henry VIII and stocked with deer for the hunt, St. James's Park is now open to the public. On sunny afternoons, Londoners picnic beneath the willows and feed the pond's resident pelicans, whose ancestors were a gift to Charles II from the Russian ambassador. The teacher saw no pelicans today. The stormy weather had brought instead seagulls from the ocean. The lawns were covered with them, hundreds of white bodies all facing the same direction, patiently riding out the damp wind. Despite the morning fog, the park afforded splendid views of the Houses of Parliament and Big Ben. Gazing across the sloping lawns, past the duck pond and the delicate silhouettes of the weeping willows, the teacher could see the spires of the building that housed the knight's tomb, the real reason he had told Remy to come to this spot. As the teacher approached the front passenger door of the parked limousine, Remy leaned across and opened the door. The teacher paused outside, taking a pull from the flask of cognac he was carrying. Then, dabbing his mouth, he slid in beside Remy and closed the door. Remy held up the keystone like a trophy. It was almost lost.
"You have done well," the teacher said.
"We have done well," Remy replied, laying the keystone in the teacher's eager hands. The teacher admired it a long moment, smiling.
"And the gun? You wiped it down?"
"Back in the glove box where I found it."
"Excellent."
The teacher took another drink of cognac and handed the flask to Remy.
"Let's toast our success. The end is near."
Remy accepted the bottle gratefully. The cognac tasted salty, but Remy didn't care. He and the teacher were truly partners now. He could feel himself ascending to a higher station in life.
"I will never be a servant again."
As Remy gazed down the embankment at the duck pond below, Chateau Villette seemed miles away. Taking another swig from the flask, Remy could feel the cognac warming his blood. The warmth in Remy's throat, however, mutated quickly to an uncomfortable heat. Loosening his bow tie, Remy tasted an unpleasant grittiness and handed the flask back to the teacher.
"I've probably had enough," he managed weakly.
Taking the flask, the teacher said,
"Remy, as you are aware, you are the only one who knows my face. I placed enormous trust in you."
"Yes," he said, feeling feverish as he loosened his tie further.
"And your identity shall go with me to the grave."
The teacher was silent a long moment.
"I believe you."
Pocketing the flask and the keystone, the teacher reached for the glove box and pulled out the tiny Medusa revolver. For an instant, Remy felt a surge of fear, but the teacher simply slipped it in his trousers pocket.
"What is he doing?"
Remy felt himself sweating suddenly.
"I know I promised you freedom," the teacher said, his voice now sounding regretful. "But considering your circumstances, this is the best I can do."
The swelling in Remy's throat came on like an earthquake, and he lurched against the steering column, grabbing his throat and tasting vomit in his narrowing esophagus. He let out a muted croak of a scream, not even loud enough to be heard outside the car. The saltiness in the cognac now registered.
"I'm being murdered!"
Incredulous, Remy turned to see the teacher sitting calmly beside him, staring straight ahead out the windshield. Remy's eyesight blurred, and he gasped for breath.
"I made everything possible for him. How could he do this?"
Whether the teacher had intended to kill Remy all along, or whether it had been Remy's actions in Temple Church that had made the teacher lose faith, Remy would never know. Terror and rage coursed through him now. Remy tried to lunge for the teacher, but his stiffening body could barely move.
"I trusted you with everything."
Remy tried to lift his clenched fists to blow the horn, but instead he slipped sideways, rolling onto the seat, lying on his side beside the teacher, clutching at his throat. The rain fell harder now. Remy could no longer see, but he could sense his oxygen-deprived brain straining to cling to his last faint shreds of lucidity. As his world slowly went black, Remy Legludec could have sworn he heard the sounds of the soft Riviera surf. The teacher stepped from the limousine, pleased to see that nobody was looking in his direction.
"I had no choice," he told himself,
surprised how little remorse he felt for what he had just done.
"Remy sealed his own fate."
The teacher had feared all along that Remy might need to be eliminated when the mission was complete, but by brazenly showing himself in Temple Church, Remy had accelerated the necessity dramatically. Admittedly, Robert Langdon's unexpected visit to Chateau Villette had brought the teacher both a fortuitous windfall and an intricate dilemma. Langdon had delivered the keystone directly to the heart of the operation, which was a pleasant surprise, and yet he had brought the police on his tail. Remy's prints were all over Chateau Villette. So was the listening post. The teacher was grateful he had taken so much care in preventing any ties between Remy's activities and his own. Nobody could implicate the teacher unless Remy talked. That was no longer a concern.
One more loose end to tie up here, the teacher thought, moving now toward the rear door of the limousine. The police will have no idea what happened, and no living witness left to tell them.
Glancing around to ensure nobody was watching, he pulled open the door and climbed into the spacious rear compartment. Minutes later, the teacher was crossing St. James Park.
Only two people now remain, Langdon and Nouveau.
They were more complicated, but manageable. At the moment, however, the teacher had the cryptex to attend to. Gazing triumphantly across the park, he could see his destination.
In London lies a pope interred.
As soon as the teacher had heard the poem, he had known the answer. Even so, that the others had not figured it out was not surprising.
I have an unfair advantage.
Having listened to Saunier's conversations for months now, the teacher had heard the Grand Master mention this famous knight on occasion, expressing esteem almost matching that he held for Da Vinci. The poem's reference to the knight was brutally simple once one saw it, a credit to Saunier's wit. And yet how this tomb would reveal the final password was still a mystery.
You seek the orb that ought be on his tomb.
The teacher vaguely recalled photos of the famous tomb and, in particular, its most distinguishing feature.
A magnificent orb.
The huge sphere mounted atop the tomb was almost as large as the tomb itself. The presence of the orb seemed both encouraging and troubling to the teacher. On one hand, it felt like a signpost. And yet, according to the poem, the missing piece of the puzzle was an orb that ought to be on his tomb, not one that was already there. He was counting on his closer inspection of the tomb to unveil the answer. The rain was getting heavier now, and he tucked the cryptex deep in his right-hand pocket to protect it from the dampness. He kept the tiny Medusa revolver in his left out of sight. Within minutes, he was stepping into the quiet sanctuary of London's grandest 900-year-old building. Just as the teacher was stepping out of the rain, Bishop Aringarosa was stepping into it. On the rainy tarmac at Biggin Airfield, Aringarosa emerged from his cramped plane, bundling his cassock against the cold damp. He had hoped to be greeted by Captain Fash. Instead, a young British officer approached with an umbrella.
Bishop Aringarosa, Captain Fash had to leave. He asked me to look after you. He suggested I take you to our London headquarters. He thought it would be safest.
Safest?
Aringarosa looked down at the heavy briefcase of Vatican bonds clutched in his hand. He had almost forgotten.
Yes, thank you.
Aringarosa climbed into the police car, wondering where Silas could be. Minutes later, the police scanner crackled with the answer. 5 Orme Court. Aringarosa recognized the address instantly. The Opus Dei Center in London. He spun to the driver.
Take me there at once.
Chapter 95. Langdon's eyes had not left the computer screen since the search began.
5 minutes, only 2 hits. Both irrelevant.
He was starting to get worried. Pamela Gedham was in the adjoining room, preparing hot drinks. Langdon and Sophie had inquired unwisely if there might be some coffee brewing alongside the tea Gedham had offered, and from the sound of the microwave beeps in the next room, Langdon suspected their request was about to be rewarded with instant Sanka. Finally, the computer pinged happily.
"Sounds like you got another," Gedham called from the next room. "What's the title?"
Langdon eyed the screen. Grail Allegory in Medieval Literature. A treatise on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
"Allegory of the Green Knight," he called back.
"No good," Gedham said. "Not many mythological green giants buried in London."
Langdon and Sophie sat patiently in front of the screen, and waited through 2 more dubious returns. When the computer pinged again, though, the offering was unexpected.
Die Operen von Richard Wagner.
The operas of Wagner?
Sophie asked. Getham peeked back in the doorway, holding a packet of instant coffee.
That seems like a strange match. Was Wagner a knight?
No, Langdon said, feeling a sudden intrigue. But he was a well-known Freemason. Along with Mozart, Beethoven, Shakespeare, Gershwin, Houdini, and Disney. Volumes had been written about the ties between the Masons and the Knights Templar, the Priory of Sion, and the Holy Grail. I want to look at this one. How do I see the full text?
You don't want the full text, Getham called. Click on the hypertext title. The computer would display your keyword hits along with mono prelogs and triple postlogs for context.
Langdon had no idea what she had just said, but he clicked anyway. A new window popped up. Mythological knight named Parsifal who... Metaphorical grail quest that arguably... The London Philharmonic in 1855. Rebecca Pope's opera anthology, The Divas... Wagner's Tomb in Bayreuth, Germany. Wrong Pope, Langdon said, disappointed. Even so, he was amazed by the system's ease of use. The keywords with context were enough to remind him that Wagner's opera Parsifal was a tribute to Mary Magdalene and the bloodline of Jesus Christ, told through the story of a young knight on a quest for truth.
Just be patient, Getham urged. It's a numbers game. Let the machine run.
Over the next few minutes, the computer returned several more Grail references, including a text about troubadours, France's famous wandering minstrels. Langdon knew it was no coincidence that the word minstrel and minister shared an etymological root. The troubadours were the traveling servants or ministers of the Church of Mary Magdalene, using music to disseminate the story of the sacred feminine among the common folk. To this day, the troubadours sang songs extolling the virtues of Our Lady, a mysterious and beautiful woman to whom they pledged themselves forever. Eagerly he checked the hypertext, but found nothing. The computer pinged again. Knights, knaves, popes, and pentacles. The history of the Holy Grail through tarot. Not surprising, Langdon said. Some of our keywords have the same names as individual cards. He reached for the mouse to click on a hyperlink. I'm not sure if your grandfather ever mentioned it when you played tarot with him, Sophie, but this game is a flashcard catechism into the story of the lost bride and her subjugation by the evil church. Sophie eyed him, looking incredulous.
I had no idea.
That's the point. By teaching through a metaphorical game, the followers of the Grail disguised their message from the watchful eye of the church. Langdon often wondered how many modern card players had any clue that their four suits, spades, hearts, clubs, diamonds, were grail-related symbols that came directly from tarot's four suits of swords, cups, scepters, and pentacles. Spades were swords, the blade, male. Hearts were cups, the chalice, feminine. Clubs were scepters, the royal line, the flowering staff. Diamonds were pentacles, the goddess, the sacred feminine. 4 minutes later, as Langdon began feeling fearful they would not find what they came for, the computer produced another hit. The Gravity of Genius. Biography of a Modern Knight. Gravity of Genius, Langdon read aloud. Bio of a Modern Knight? Getham stuck her head around the corner.
How modern? Please don't tell me it's your Sir Rudy Giuliani. We were all just sick over that decision.
Langdon had his own qualms about the newly knighted Sir Mick Jagger, but this hardly seemed the moment to debate the politics of modern British knighthood. Let's have a look. Langdon summoned up the hypertext keywords. Honorable Knight, Sir Isaac Newton. In London, in 1727, and... His tomb, in Westminster Abbey, the... Alexander Pope, friend and colleague.
I guess modern is a relative term, Sophie called to Getham. It's an old book about Sir Isaac Newton.
Getham shook her head in the doorway.
Now good. Newton was buried in Westminster Abbey, the seat of English Protestantism. There's no way a Catholic Pope was present. Cream and sugar?
Sophie nodded. Getham waited.
Robert?
Langdon's heart was hammering. He pulled his eyes from the screen and stood up. Sir Isaac Newton is our knight. Sophie remained seated.
What are you talking about?
Newton is buried in London, Langdon said. His labors produced new sciences that incurred the wrath of the church, and he was a grand master of the Priory of Sion. What more could we want?
What more?
Sophie pointed to the poem.
How about a knight a pope interred? You heard, Miss Gettum. Newton was not buried by a Catholic pope.
Langdon reached for the mouse. Who said anything about a Catholic pope? He clicked on the pope hyperlink, and the complete sentence appeared. Sir Isaac Newton's burial, attended by kings and nobles, was presided over by Alexander Pope, friend and colleague, who gave a stirring eulogy before sprinkling dirt on the tomb. Langdon looked at Sophie. We had the correct pope on our second hit, Alexander. He paused. A. Pope? In London lies a knight, A. Pope, interred? Sophie stood up, looking stunned. Jacques Saunière, the master of double entendres, had proven once again that he was a frighteningly clever man. Chapter 96. Silas awoke with a start. He had no idea what had woken him, or how long he had been asleep.
Was I dreaming?
Sitting up now on his straw mat, he listened to the quiet breathing of the Opus Dei residence hall, the stillness textured only by the soft murmurs of someone praying aloud in a room below him. These were familiar sounds, and should have comforted him. And yet he felt a sudden and unexpected wariness. Standing, wearing only his undergarments, Silas walked to the window.
Was I followed?
The courtyard below was deserted, exactly as he had seen it when he entered. He listened. Silence.
So why am I uneasy?
Silas long ago had learned to trust his intuition. Intuition had kept him alive as a child on the streets of Marseille long before prison, long before he was born again by the hand of Bishop Aringarosa. Peering out the window again, he now saw the faint outline of a blue sedan through the hedge. On the sedan's roof was a siren. A floorboard creaked in the hallway. A door latch moved. Silas reacted on instinct, surging across the room and sliding to a stop just behind the door as it crashed open. The first officer stormed through, swinging his gun left then right at what appeared an empty room. Before he realized where Silas was, Silas had thrown his shoulder into the door, crushing a second officer as he came through. As the first officer wheeled to shoot, Silas dove for his legs. The gun went off, the bullet sailing above Silas's head, just as he connected with the officer's shins, driving his legs out from under him, and sending the man down, his head hitting the floor. The second officer staggered to his feet in the doorway, and Silas drove a knee into his groin, then went clambering over the writhing body, into the hall. Almost naked, Silas hurled his pale body down the long switchback staircase. He knew he had been betrayed, but by whom? When he reached the foyer, more officers were surging through the front door. Silas turned the other way and dashed deeper into the residence hall.
The women's entrance. Every Opus Dei building has one.
Winding down narrow hallways, Silas snaked through a kitchen, past terrified workers, who left to avoid the naked albino as he knocked over bowl and silverware, bursting into a dark hallway near the boiler room. He now saw the door he sought, an exit light gleaming at the end. Running full speed through the door out into the rain, Silas leapt off the low landing, not seeing the officer coming the other way until it was too late. The two men collided, Silas's broad, naked shoulder grinding into the man's sternum with crushing force. He drove the officer backwards onto the pavement, landing hard on top of him. The officer's gun clattered away. Silas could hear men running down the hall, shouting. Rolling, he grabbed the loose gun just as the officers emerged. A shot rang out on the stairs, and Silas felt a searing pain below his ribs. Filled with rage, he opened fire at all three officers, their blood spraying. A dark shadow loomed behind, coming out of nowhere. The angry hands that grabbed at his bare shoulders felt like they were infused with the power of the devil himself. The man roared in his ear,
"Silas, no!"
Silas spun and fired. Their eyes met. Silas was already screaming in horror as Bishop Aringarosa fell. Chapter 97. More than 3,000 people are entombed or enshrined within Westminster Abbey. The colossal stone interior burgeons with the remains of kings, statesmen, scientists, poets, and musicians. Their tombs, packed into every last niche and alcove, range in grandeur from the most regal of mausoleums, that of Queen Elizabeth I, whose canopied sarcophagus inhabits its own private apsidal chapel, down to the most modest etched floor tiles, whose inscriptions have worn away with centuries of foot traffic, leaving it to one's imagination whose relics might lie below the tile in the undercroft. Designed in the style of the great cathedrals of Amiens, Chartres, and Canterbury, Westminster Abbey is considered neither cathedral nor parish church. It bears the classification of royal peculiar, subject only to the sovereign. Since hosting the coronation of William the Conqueror on Christmas Day in 1066, the dazzling sanctuary has witnessed an endless procession of royal ceremonies and affairs of state, from the canonization of Edward the Confessor to the funeral of Henry V, to the marriage of Lady Diana and Prince Charles. Even so, Robert Langdon currently felt no interest in any of the Abbey's ancient history, save one event, the funeral of the British knight, Sir Isaac Newton. In London lies a knight, a pope interred. Hurrying through the grand portico on a north transept, Langdon and Sophie were met by guards who politely ushered them through the Abbey's newest addition. A large walk-through metal detector, now present in most historic buildings in London. They both passed through without setting off the alarm, and continued to the Abbey entrance. Stepping across the threshold into Westminster Abbey, Langdon felt the outside world evaporate with a sudden hush. No rumble of traffic, no hiss of rain, just a deafening silence which seemed to reverberate back and forth as if the building were whispering to itself. Langdon and Sophie's eyes, like those of almost every visitor, shifted immediately skyward, where the Abbey's great abyss seemed to explode overhead. Gray stone columns ascended like redwoods into the shadows, arching gracefully over dizzying expanses, and then shooting back down to the stone floor. Before them, the wide alley of the north transept stretched out like a deep canyon, flanked by sheer cliffs of stained glass. On sunny days, the Abbey floor was a prismatic patchwork of light. Today, the rain and darkness gave this massive hollow a wraith-like aura, more like that of the crypt it truly was.
"It's practically empty," Sophie whispered.
Langdon felt disappointed. He had hoped for a lot more people, a more public place. Their earlier experience in the deserted temple church was not one Langdon wanted to repeat. He had been anticipating a certain feeling of security in the popular tourist destination, but Langdon's recollections of bustling throngs in a well-lit abbey had been during peak summer tourist season. Today was a rainy March morning. Rather than crowds and shimmering stained glass, all Langdon saw was acres of desolate floor and shadowy empty alcoves.
"We passed through metal detectors,"
Sophie reminded, apparently sensing Langdon's apprehension.
"If anyone is in here, they can't be armed."
Langdon nodded, but still felt circumspect. He had wanted to bring the London police with them, but Sophie's fears of who might be involved put a damper on any contact with the authorities.
"We need to recover the cryptex," Sophie had insisted. "It is the key to everything."
She was right, of course. The key to getting Lee back alive. The key to finding the Holy Grail. The key to learning who is behind this. Unfortunately, their only chance to recover the keystone seemed to be here and now, at the tomb of Isaac Newton. Whoever held the cryptex would have to pay a visit to the tomb to decipher the final clue. And if they had not already come and gone, Sophie and Langdon intended to intercept them. Striding toward the left wall to get out of the open, they moved into an obscure side aisle, behind a row of pilasters. Langdon couldn't shake the image of Lee Teabing being held captive, probably tied up in the back of his own limousine. Whoever had ordered the top priory members killed would not hesitate to eliminate others who stood in the way. It seemed a cruel irony that Teabing, a modern British knight, was a hostage in the search for his own kinsman, Sir Isaac Newton.
"Which way is it?" Sophie asked, looking around.
"The tomb." Langdon had no idea. "We should find a docent and ask." Langdon knew better than to wander aimlessly in here. Westminster Abbey was a tangled warren of mausoleums, perimeter chambers, and walk-in burial niches. Like the Louvre's Grand Gallery, it had a lone point of entry, the door through which they had just passed. Easy to find your way in, but impossible to find your way out. A literal tourist trap, one of Langdon's befuddled colleagues had called it. Like most cathedrals, the abbey was laid out in the shape of a giant cruciform. Unlike most cathedrals, however, it had its entrance on the side, rather than the standard rear of the church via the narthex at the bottom of the nave. Moreover, the abbey had a sprawling cloister attached. One false step through the wrong archway, and a visitor was lost in a labyrinth of outdoor courtyards surrounded by high walls. "Docents wear crimson robes," Langdon said, approaching the center of the church. Peering obliquely across the towering gilded altar to the far end of the south transept, Langdon saw several people crawling on their hands and knees. This prostrate pilgrimage was a common occurrence in Poet's Corner, although it was far less holy than it appeared. Tourists doing grave rubbings.
"I don't see any docents," Sophie said. "Maybe we can find the tomb on our own."
Without a word, Langdon led her another few steps to the center of the abbey and pointed to the right. Sophie drew a startled breath as she looked down the full length of the abbey's nave, the full magnitude of the building now visible.
"Ah," she said, "let's find a docent."
At that moment, 100 yards down the nave, out of sight behind the choir screen, the stately tomb of Sir Isaac Newton had a lone visitor. The teacher had been scrutinizing the monument for 10 minutes now. Newton's tomb consisted of a massive black marble sarcophagus on which reclined the sculpted form of Sir Isaac Newton, wearing classical costume and leaning proudly against a stack of his own books, Divinity, Chronology, Optics, and Philosophia Naturalis Principia Mathematica. At Newton's feet stood 2 winged boys holding a scroll. Behind Newton's recumbent body rose an austere pyramid. Although the pyramid itself seemed an oddity, it was the giant shape mounted halfway up the pyramid that most intrigued the teacher. An orb. The teacher pondered Sonnier's beguiling riddle.
"You seek the orb that ought be on his tomb."
The massive orb protruding from the face of the pyramid was carved in basso relievo and depicted all kinds of heavenly bodies, constellations, signs of the zodiac, comets, stars, and planets. Above it, the image of the goddess of astronomy beneath a field of stars.
"Countless orbs."
The teacher had been convinced that once he found the tomb, discerning the missing orb would be easy. Now he was not so sure. He was gazing at a complicated map of the heavens. Was there a missing planet? Had some astronomical orb been omitted from a constellation? He had no idea. Even so, the teacher could not help but suspect that the solution would be ingeniously clean and simple.
"A knight a pope interred.
Crystal clear once you saw it.
What orb am I looking for?"
Certainly an advanced knowledge of astrophysics was not a prerequisite for finding the Holy Grail, was it?
"It speaks of rosy flesh and seeded womb."
The teacher's concentration was broken by several approaching tourists. He slipped the cryptex back in his pocket and watched warily as the visitors went to a nearby table, left a donation in the cup, and restocked on the complimentary grave-rubbing supplies set out by the abbey. Armed with fresh charcoal pencils and large sheets of heavy paper, they headed off toward the front of the abbey, probably to the popular Poet's Corner, to pay their respects to Chaucer, Tennyson, and Dickens by scribbling furiously on their graves. Alone again, he stepped closer to the tomb, scanning it from bottom to top. He began with the clawed feet beneath the sarcophagus, moved upward past Newton, past his books on science, past the 2 boys with their mathematical scroll, up the face of the pyramid to the giant orb with its constellations, and finally up to the niche's star-filled canopy.
"What orb ought to be here?"
and yet is missing.
He touched the cryptex in his pocket, as if he could somehow osmosize the answer from Sonier's crafted marble.
Only 5 letters separate me from the Grail.
Pacing now, near the corner of the choir screen, he took a deep breath and glanced up the long nave toward the main altar in the distance. His gaze dropped from the gilded altar down to the bright crimson robe of an abbey docent, who was being waved over by 2 very familiar individuals, Langdon and Neveu. Calmly, the teacher moved 2 steps back behind the choir screen.
That was fast.
He had anticipated Langdon and Sophie would eventually decipher the poem's meaning and come to Newton's tomb, but this was sooner than he had imagined. Taking a deep breath, the teacher considered his options. He had grown accustomed to dealing with surprises.
I am holding the cryptex.
Reaching down to his pocket, he touched the second object that gave him his confidence, the Medusa revolver. As expected, the Abbey's metal detectors had blared as the teacher passed through with the concealed gun. Also as expected, the guards had backed off at once when the teacher glared indignantly and flashed his identification card. Official rank always commanded the proper respect. Although initially the teacher had hoped to solve the cryptex alone and avoid any further complications, he now sensed that the arrival of Langdon and Neveu was actually a welcome development. Considering the lack of success he was having with the orb reference, he might be able to use their expertise. After all, if Langdon had deciphered the poem to find the tomb, there was a reasonable chance he also knew something about the orb. And if Langdon knew the password, then it was just a matter of applying the right pressure.
Not here, of course. Somewhere private.
The teacher recalled a small announcement sign he had seen on his way into the abbey. Immediately, he knew the perfect place to lure them. The only question now, what to use as bait. Chapter 98. Langdon and Sophie moved slowly down the north aisle, keeping to the shadows behind the ample pillars that separated it from the open nave. Despite having traveled more than halfway down the nave, they still had no clear view of Newton's tomb. The sarcophagus was recessed in a niche, obscured from this oblique angle.
"At least there's nobody over there," Sophie whispered.
Langdon nodded, relieved. The entire section of the nave near Newton's tomb was deserted.
"I'll go over," he whispered. "You should stay hidden, just in case someone..."
Sophie had already stepped from the shadows and was headed across the open floor.
"Is watching," Langdon sighed, hurrying to join her.
Crossing the massive nave on a diagonal, Langdon and Sophie remained silent as the elaborate sepulchre revealed itself in tantalizing increments. A black marble sarcophagus, a reclining statue of Newton, 2 winged boys, a huge pyramid, and an enormous orb.
"Did you know about that?"
Sophie said, sounding startled. Langdon shook his head, also surprised.
"Those look like constellations carved on it," Sophie said.
As they approached the niche, Langdon felt a slow, sinking sensation. Newton's tomb was covered with orbs. Stars, comets, planets.
"You seek the orb that ought be on his tomb."
It could turn out to be like trying to find a missing blade of grass on a golf course.
"Astronomical bodies," Sophie said, looking concerned. "And a lot of them."
Langdon frowned. The only link between the planets and the Grail that Langdon could imagine was the pentacle of Venus, and he had already tried the password Venus en route to Temple Church. Sophie moved directly to the sarcophagus, but Langdon hung back a few feet, keeping an eye on the abbey around them.
"Divinity,"
Sophie said, tilting her head and reading the titles of the books on which Newton was leaning.
"Chronology, Optics, Philosophia Naturalis Principia Mathematica?"
She turned to him.
"Ring any bells?"
Langdon stepped closer, considering it. "Principia Mathematica, as I remember, has something to do with the gravitation pull of planets, which admittedly are orbs, but it seems a little far-fetched."
"How about the signs of the zodiac?"
Sophie asked, pointing to the constellations on the orb.
"You were talking about Pisces and Aquarius earlier, weren't you?"
"The end of days," Langdon thought.
The end of Pisces and beginning of Aquarius was allegedly the historical marker at which the Priory planned to release the Sangreal documents to the world. But the millennium came and went without incident, leaving historians uncertain when the truth was coming.
"It seems possible," Sophie said, "that the Priory's plans to reveal the truth might be related to the last line of the poem.
It speaks of rosy flesh and seeded womb." Langdon felt a shiver of potential. He had not considered the line that way before.
"You told me earlier," she said, "that the timing of the Priory's plans to unveil the truth about the rose and her fertile womb was linked directly to the position of planets. Orbs."
Langdon nodded, feeling the first faint wisps of possibility materializing. Even so, his intuition told him astronomy was not the key. The Grand Master's previous solutions had all possessed an eloquent, symbolic significance. The Mona Lisa, Madonna of the Rocks, Sophia. This eloquence was definitely lacking in the concept of planetary orbs and the zodiac. Thus far, Jacques Saunier had proven himself a meticulous code writer, and Langdon had to believe that his final password, those five letters that unlocked the Priory's ultimate secret, would prove to be not only symbolically fitting, but also crystal clear. If this solution were anything like the others, it would be painfully obvious once it dawned.
"Look," Sophie gasped,
jarring his thoughts as she grabbed his arm. From the fear in her touch, Langdon sensed someone must be approaching, but when he turned to her, she was staring aghast at the top of the black marble sarcophagus.
"Someone was here,"
she whispered, pointing to a spot on the sarcophagus near Newton's outstretched right foot. Langdon did not understand her concern. A careless tourist had left a charcoal grave-rubbing pencil on the sarcophagus lid near Newton's foot. "It's nothing." Langdon reached out to pick it up, but as he leaned toward the sarcophagus, the light shifted on the polished black marble slab, and Langdon froze. Suddenly, he saw why Sophie was afraid. Scrawled on the sarcophagus lid, at Newton's feet, shimmered a barely visible charcoal pencil message. "I have Teabing. Go through chapter house, out south exit, to public garden." Langdon read the words twice, his heart pounding wildly. Sophie turned and scanned the nave. Despite the pall of trepidation that settled over him upon seeing the words, Langdon told himself this was good news. Lee is still alive. There was another implication here, too.
"They don't know the password either," he whispered.
Sophie nodded. Otherwise, why make their presence known?
"They may want to trade Lee for the password."
"Or it's a trap."
Langdon shook his head.
"I don't think so. The garden is outside the Abbey walls, a very public place."
Langdon had once visited the Abbey's famous college garden, a small fruit orchard and herb garden, left over from the days when monks grew natural pharmacological remedies here. Boasting the oldest living fruit trees in Great Britain, College Garden was a popular spot for tourists to visit without having to enter the Abbey.
"I think sending us outside is a show of faith, so we feel safe."
Sophie looked dubious.
"You mean outside, where there are no metal detectors?"
Langdon scowled. She had a point. Gazing back at the orb-filled tomb, Langdon wished he had some idea about the cryptic's password. Something with which to negotiate.
"I got Lee involved tonight, and I'll do whatever it takes if there's a chance to help him."
"The note says go through the chapter house to the south exit," Sophie said. "Maybe from the exit we would have a view of the garden? That way we could assess the situation before we walked out there and exposed ourselves to any danger."
The idea was a good one. Langdon vaguely recalled the chapter house as a huge octagonal hall where the original British Parliament convened in the days before the modern Parliament building existed. It had been years since he had been there, but he vaguely recalled it being out through the cloister somewhere. Taking several steps back from the tomb, Langdon peered around the choir screen to his right, across the nave to the side opposite that which they had descended. A gaping vaulted passageway stood nearby, with a large sign, "This way to cloister, deanery, college hall, museum, Pick's chamber, St. Faith's chapel, chapter house." Langdon and Sophie were jogging as they passed beneath the sign, moving too quickly to notice the small announcement that had also been posted at the Abbey entrance, apologizing that certain areas were closed for renovations. They emerged immediately into the Abbey's main cloister, a high-walled, open-roof courtyard through which morning rain was falling. Above them, the wind howled across the opening with a low drone, like someone blowing over the mouth of a bottle. Entering the narrow, low-hanging walkways that bordered the courtyard perimeter, Langdon felt the familiar uneasiness he always felt in enclosed spaces. These walkways were also called cloisters, and Langdon noted with uneasiness that these particular cloisters lived up to their Latin ties to the word claustrophobic. Focusing his mind straight ahead toward the end of the tunnel, Langdon followed the signs for the chapter house. The rain was spitting now, and the walkway was cold and damp with gusts of rain that blew through the lone pillared wall that was the cloister's only source of light. Another couple scurried past them the other way, hurrying to get out of the worsening weather. The cloisters looked deserted now, admittedly the abbey's least enticing section in the wind and rain. 40 yards down the east cloister, an archway materialized on their left, giving way to another hallway. Although this was the entrance they were looking for, the opening was cordoned off by a swag and official-looking sign, "Closed for renovation. Pick's Chamber, St. Faith's Chapel, Chapter House." The long deserted corridor beyond the swag was littered with scaffolding and drop cloths. Immediately beyond the swag, Langdon could see the entrances to the Pick's Chamber and St. Faith's Chapel on the right and left. The entrance to the chapter house, however, was much farther away, at the far end of the long hallway. Even from here, Langdon could see that its heavy wooden door was wide open, and the spacious octagonal interior was bathed in a grayish natural light from the room's many enormous windows that looked out on College Garden. "Go through the chapter house, out the south exit, to the public garden." "We just left the east cloister," Langdon said. "So the south exit to the garden must be through there and to the right." Sophie was already stepping over the swag and moving forward. As they hurried down the dark corridor, the sounds of the wind and rain from the open cloister faded behind them. The chapter house was a kind of satellite structure, a freestanding annex at the end of the long hallway to ensure the privacy of the Parliament proceedings housed there.
"It looks huge," Sophie whispered as they approached.
Langdon had forgotten just how large this room was. Even from outside, approaching the entrance, Langdon could gaze across the vast expanse of floor to the breathtaking windows on the far side of the octagon, which rose 5 stories to a vaulted ceiling. They would certainly have a clear view of the garden from in here. Crossing the threshold, both Langdon and Sophie found themselves having to squint. After the gloomy cloisters, the chapter house felt like a solarium. They were a good 10 feet into the room, searching the south wall, when they realized the door they had been promised was not there. They were standing in an enormous dead end. The creaking of a heavy door behind them made them turn, just as the door closed with a resounding thud and the latch fell into place. The lone man who had been standing behind the door looked calm as he aimed a small revolver at them. He was portly, and was propped on a pair of aluminum polio braces. For a moment, Langdon thought he must be dreaming. It was Lee Teabing. Chapter 99. Sir Lee Teabing felt rueful as he gazed out over the barrel of his Medusa revolver at Robert Langdon and Sophie Neveu.
"My friends," he said, "since the moment you walked into my home last night, I have done everything in my power to keep you out of harm's way. But your persistence has now put me in a difficult position."
He could see the expressions of shock and betrayal on Sophie and Langdon's faces, and yet he was confident that soon they would both understand the chain of events that had guided the three of them to this unlikely crossroads.
"There is so much I have to tell you both, so much you do not yet understand." "Please believe," Teabing said, "I never had any intention of your being involved. You came to my home. You came searching for me."
"Lee?" Langdon finally managed.
"What the hell are you doing? We thought you were in trouble. We came here to help you."
"As I trusted you would," he said. "We have much to discuss." Langdon and Sophie seemed unable to tear their stunned gazes from the revolver aimed at them.
"It is simply to ensure your full attention," Teabing said. "If I had wanted to harm you, you would be dead by now. When you walked into my home last night, I risked everything to spare your lives. I am a man of honor, and I vowed in my deepest conscience only to sacrifice those who had betrayed the Sangreal."
"What are you talking about?" Langdon said. "Betrayed the Sangreal?"
"I discovered a terrible truth," Teabing said, sighing. "I learned why the Sangreal documents were never revealed to the world. I learned that the Priory had decided not to release the truth after all. That's why the millennium passed without any revelation, why nothing happened as we entered End of Days."
Langdon drew a breath, about to protest.
"The Priory," Teabing continued, "was given a sacred charge to share the truth, to release the Sangreal documents when the End of Days arrived. For centuries, men like Da Vinci, Botticelli, and Newton risked everything to protect the documents and carry out that charge. And now, at the ultimate moment of truth, Jacques Saunière changed his mind. The man honored with the greatest responsibility in Christian history eschewed his duty. He decided the time was not right."
Teabing turned to Sophie.
"He failed the Grail. He failed the Priory. And he failed the memory of all the generations that had sacrificed to make that moment possible."
"You," Sophie declared, glancing up now, her green eyes boring into him with rage and realization.
"You are the one responsible for my grandfather's murder?"
Teabing scoffed. "Your grandfather and his seneschal were traitors to the Grail." Sophie felt a fury rising from deep within.
"He's lying."
Teabing's voice was relentless. "Your grandfather sold out to the church. It is obvious they pressured him to keep the truth quiet." Sophie shook her head.
"The church had no influence on my grandfather."
Teabing laughed coldly. "My dear, the church has 2,000 years' experience pressuring those who threaten to unveil its lies. Since the days of Constantine, the church has successfully hidden the truth about Mary Magdalene and Jesus. We should not be surprised that now, once again, they have found a way to keep the world in the dark. The church may no longer employ crusaders to slaughter non-believers, but their influence is no less persuasive, no less insidious." He paused, as if to punctuate his next point. "Miss Neveu, for some time now, your grandfather has wanted to tell you the truth about your family." Sophie gasped.
"How could you know that?"
"My methods are immaterial. The important thing for you to grasp right now is this." He took a deep breath. "The deaths of your mother, father, grandmother, and brother were not accidental." The words sent Sophie's emotions reeling. She opened her mouth to speak, but was unable to respond. Langdon shook his head.
"What are you saying, Lee?"
"Robert, it explains everything. All the pieces fit. History repeats itself. The church has a precedent of murder when it comes to silencing the Sangreal. With the End of Days imminent, killing the Grand Master's loved ones sent a very clear message. Be quiet, or you and Sophie are next." "It was a car accident," Sophie stammered, feeling the childhood pain welling inside her. "An accident."
"Bedtime stories to protect your innocence," Teabing said.
"Consider that only 2 family members went untouched. The Priory's Grand Master and his lone grandchild. The perfect pair to provide the church with control over the Brotherhood. I can only imagine the terror the church wielded over your grandfather these past years, threatening to kill you if he dared release the Sangreal secret, threatening to finish the job they started unless Saunière influenced the Priory to reconsider its ancient vow."
"Lee," Langdon argued, now visibly riled, "certainly you have no proof that the church had anything to do with those deaths, or that it influenced the Priory's decision to remain silent."
"Proof?" Teabing fired back. "You want proof the Priory was influenced? The new millennium has arrived, and yet the world remains ignorant.
Is that not proof enough?
In the echoes of Teabing's words, Sophie heard another voice speaking.
Sophie, I must tell you the truth about your family.